From Ohio to Nevada, Missouri to Michigan, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it has been 1 year since Neil Gorsuch was appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States. Has he fulfilled conservative hopes? Tiffany Bates of the Heritage Foundation is here to discuss. An unusual 7-month campaign for Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives is underway. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on the impact. Complying with government regulations is a major expense to most businesses. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks about the federal regulatory state with Clyde Wayne Cruz of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And the Nation of Israel is celebrating its 70th anniversary. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary on the challenges that lie ahead. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. 1 year ago, Neil Gorsuch became the newest justice on the Supreme Court of the United States, replacing the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Scalia was part of the court's conservative wing, and hopes were that Gorsuch would become a worthy heir. Here to talk about his record on the court is Tiffany Bates. Tiffany is a legal policy analyst at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Tiffany, welcome to American Radio Journal. Tiffany, it's been about 1 year since Neil Gorsuch was placed on the Supreme Court of the United States. Looking back over the year, what sort of impact has the new justice had?
I think Justice Gorsuch is all we hope for and more. And he's definitely leaving his mark on the court, showing that he works really hard, writes very clearly, and cares deeply about getting the law right.
Are there any particular cases that he has been a pivotal vote in so far?
Yeah, I think he's voted in a lot of important cases. So the first one out of last term, Trinity Lutheran Church versus Comer, was a decision where the court held that a state can't deny otherwise public benefits to a church on account of its religious status. And Justice Gorsuch voted on behalf of the school that is affiliated with the church in that case. They just wanted playground equipment, the soft surface, so when their kids fall, they don't get hurt, just like everybody else in the state. And I also think his dissents have been really on point so far, picking up very important themes. In one dissent, the case was kind of boring. It was about a statute of limitations. But he wrote some very important things like, you know, we've wandered so far from the idea that of a federal government of limited and enumerated powers that we've begun to lose sight of what it looked like in the first place. And he's also joined some dissents of denial of cert. So when the court refuses to hear a case, sometimes a justice will dissent and say, I think we should have heard that case. It's very important. And Justice Gorsuch has signed on with Justice Thomas on a few of these cases, including an important Second Amendment case. And they lamented the court for continuing to treat the Second Amendment as a disfavored right. And I think all of these cases really show how thoughtful he is and, you know, how he views government power and his role as a judge.
This is, of course, the first term where he has been a justice for the full term. We do have some important cases that are pending, and we will have decisions coming likely in late May or certainly at some point in June, one of which is a key labor power case. Can you tell us a little bit about what impact having Justice Gorsuch on the Supreme Court could have on that particular case, which, if memory serves me correctly, was not reviewed before because the court tied out at 4-4.
Yeah, that's right. When the court heard the Friedrichs case last term, they expected Friedrichs to win that case, but after Justice Scalia passed away, the court split 4-4, which meant the lower court decision stood, and so the teacher in that case lost. But there's a different case brought up this term, Janus. So Janus is an important First Amendment case that will determine whether the government can force objectors to pay union fees. So there's this old Supreme Court case from 1977 called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that public employees can be required to pay union fees even if they have opted out of joining the union. And so in these arrangements, they're called agency shop arrangement. a single union rep gets the power to represent all of the public employees and speak for them and contract for them, even the ones that don't want to join the union or don't want to support the union's advocacy. The other side talks about there's a free rider problem and they're just paying their fair share of the union dues. And Justice Gorsuch at oral argument did not ask a single question, which is not common for him. He's usually a pretty avid questioner. So he tried not to tip his hand in this, but I think that based on the way he views the First Amendment and other cases, I think that he is probably going to vote to overturn Abood in this case. At least I hope so.
We will, of course, keep a close eye on that over the coming couple of months. Also, let's talk for just a minute, Tiffany, here about judicial appointments in general. Of course, President Trump had the opportunity to appoint Neil Gorsuch. That's having a profound impact at the highest level. But the other federal courts, has the president been making any progress in terms of getting nominations sent over to the Senate and getting those nominations confirmed?
Yeah, so the president is doing a great job nominating qualified conservative judges to sit on these lower courts, but they're really getting held up in the Senate. To date, the Senate has confirmed only 32 judges, including Justice Gorsuch, and President Trump has sent them so many more nominees than that. And, you know, Chuck Grassley is doing a good job getting these nominees through their hearings in the Judiciary Committee, because first they have to have a hearing in the Judiciary Committee. Then the committee will vote, then they're sent to the full Senate floor, and the full Senate has to vote, and that's really where they're getting held up. And there's this so-called 30-hour rule, where once the full Senate moves to limit debate, and they take that first vote, then there's a rule that says you can have up to 30 hours of additional debate after that. And this doesn't mean 30 consecutive hours, it means 30 hours when the Senate is in session, so it could take days to get to that 30 hours. And the Democrats keep making them wait 30 hours on each nominee, even ones that are non-controversial and who are unanimously or almost unanimously voted out, you know, like the district court nominees. But they're making the 30 hours run on every single nominee, which is what is really backing up all these nominees, and they can't just confirm them all. And it also doesn't help that the Senate's only working 2.5 days a week. So we're really hoping that some process reforms are coming soon.
We have been talking with Tiffany Bates, who is a legal policy analyst at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, that, of course, at the Heritage Foundation. Tiffany, tell us a little bit about Heritage and where can folks go to read your writings on this and other subjects?
Heritage is a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., and we write about issues, all sorts of issues from national security, economic policy, social issues, and legal issues, of course. And you can find all of our research and writing on heritage.org.
Tiffany Bates of the Heritage Foundation. Tiffany, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Andy Roth is at the offices of the Club for Growth. Some interesting activity is occurring in Congress, not of the legislative variety, but sort of as the organizational or political variety. Andy, good to have you here to talk about that.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Speaker Paul Ryan, as we discussed last week, has announced his retirement. That is triggering a race for either Speaker or Minority Leader, depending on whether or not Republicans retain control of the House. That field has changed a little bit, maybe solidified a little bit in the last week. What's the lay of the land?
Well, what's the most interesting out of this is that, and I'm no political historian, but speakers' races typically last only a couple of weeks. Once an election is settled, then the conference in power, everybody lobbies each other, and then they pick somebody just a couple weeks later. Here, we have a 7-month runway with which to influence the outcome. And that's good news for conservatives because they can build grassroots pressure and nationalize the race. If it's just a couple of weeks, typically it's an insider baseball game that is difficult to influence. So Paul Ryan's retirement is very good for conservatives. Now, here's the slimy thing, is that people who represent the establishment and want an establishment person as speaker, they are trying to get Paul Ryan to resign so that he is vacated immediately and so that they can have a speaker's race that only lasts a couple of weeks rather than 7 months. Paul Ryan has pushed back against that, saying that's nuts. I can still raise a gob of money for the Republican Party, which is true. And I think he still has a lot of things he wants to do before he retires at the end of the year. So you've got that little side drama playing out, and maybe the establishment eventually wins. I don't know. But there's that. And then the candidates themselves appear to be Kevin McCarthy, who is considered the favorite. But as you may recall, when he tried to run for speaker last go-around, he knew he didn't have the vote, so he had to back out. So since then, McCarthy has been trying to rebuild his vote total by playing nice with all of the members of the conference. I don't know that that's going to work with conservatives because he's not a conservative. So he is clearly the front runner, but it is possible at some point that he may not have the votes. That's why you're seeing conservatives like Jim Jordan throw their hat in the ring. I don't think Jordan has officially done that, but he's letting people talk about him as a possible candidate. This thing is still early, but you're starting to see the battle lines kind of sharpen. And then there's Steve Scalise, who we thought was going to run against McCarthy, but he said he would not. What he did say, though, is that if McCarthy does not have the votes, then Scalise would jump in and make a run at it. So you basically got three candidates running right now, and things will obviously heat up as we go along. What's important here, though, is that McCarthy needs conservatives more than conservatives need McCarthy. So I suspect he'll be on his best behavior from now until the end of the year.
What impact would there be on this race, Andy, if Republicans lose control of Congress, if Democrats win the number of seats in this midterm election, which historically midterm elections are not kind to the party of the newly elected president, in this case, Republican Donald Trump? What impact would that have on the speaker's race?
That's a good point. And it's a very fundamental point, because if the speaker's race is decided in public on the House floor, Democrats and Republicans all vote. And if Republicans, if enough conservatives do not like a particular candidate like Kevin McCarthy, then they can vote present, they can vote for somebody else, they can do whatever they want, and they can effectively block McCarthy's speakership, because the speaker has to get 218 votes. There's no other way. So if McCarthy can't get those 218, then the Democrats retire to their cloakroom, Republicans retire to their cloakroom, and they figure out who else is going to run. If Republicans are in the minority, then what they're doing is electing their minority leader, and that is not a floor vote. That is not a public vote. That is a secret ballot in conference, and majority wins. Under that circumstance, it heavily favors the establishment, because conservatives make up only a minority of the Republican conference, not a majority. So whoever their preference is, probably Kevin McCarthy, then he would likely win.
On the Democrat side, it always appears to me, Andy, that Democrats are more united than Republicans when it comes to this. If Democrats retain control or regain control of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi likely again, would she become Speaker?
Amazingly not. There has been a lot of disgruntled members, Democrats, publicly talking about how they don't want to continue doing the same old thing that they have been doing for, gosh, I don't know, what's it been now, 12, 15 years? I don't know. But there's a Congressman, Joe Crowley from New York, who is talking very publicly about challenging Pelosi. Now, others have tried that before, but she always wins. She represents San Francisco, obviously, so she's got the entire California delegation behind her. She has all of the far left Democrats representing her. Joe Crowley is not a spring chicken, so it's not like this would be a generational fight where Grandma Pelosi is going up against a young, good-looking guy. Joe Crowley is a New York Democrat. I don't know how he's going to pick votes away from Pelosi, but I think his message is basically, listen, we've been doing this for too long. We got to shake up leadership.
Now, let's talk for just a minute here about a special election coming up this week in Arizona.
This one has been going on for a while, and thankfully it's coming to a conclusion. But Trent Franks, the incumbent, resigned because of a personal scandal. It's a very Republican district. Trent Franks was a very conservative member. And right now, the Democrats have fielded a candidate who's not straight out of central casting, but she's a female, she's a doctor, and she's portraying herself as a moderate. So the Democrats think that they may have an outside chance of winning this, but right now it looks like it's probably going to stay with Republicans. If for some reason the Democrats do win, then batten down the hatches, because November will get really ugly.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
And now, Clyde Wayne Cruz of the Competitive Enterprise Institute joins Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine for a discussion on the size of the federal regulatory state. Eric?
When I was in school, and I don't know if they even still teach it this way, but when I was in school, we learned that there were three branches of the government. There's the legislature, the Congress, they pass the laws. There's the executive branch, which is headed by the president, and they enforce the laws. And then there's the judiciary, the courts, and all that, and then they, you know, adjudicate the laws when there's disputes. That's not the way it is anymore. It's just simply not the way things work. There's an entire fourth branch of government that operates off the books. It's the regulatory state. And that is what we are taking a look at today. Thanks so much for joining us, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. You're listening to American Radio Journal. And my guest today is Wayne Cruz. He's the Vice President for Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And he is the author of an annual report that they put out, the latest edition of which just came out this week. 10,000 Commandments is the name of the report. And it is a complete summary, a look at all of these things that happen off the books in the regulatory state, the administrative state, whatever you want to call it. He really does a terrific job every year of tracking this, categorizing and analyzing all of it. Wayne, we really appreciate you being here.
You bet. Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, this report, 10,000 Commandments, it looks at all of those things that happen in the federal government that are not part of the three branches that we learn about, the legislature, the executive, and the judicial. You guys have done this report every year now for 25 years. This is the 25th anniversary, so congratulations there. But this is a significant year in another way, too, because you're looking at the first year of the Trump administration and the number of new regulations on the books in 2017, last year, that this report looks at, significantly down from what you had tracked in previous years.
Yeah, it is significant. I guess the biggest takeaway from 10,000 Commandments, this annual report, we try to track sort of the hidden tax of regulation, you might say, the off-budget scope of government. And usually the trajectory is straight up. And in Obama's last year, the Federal Register had hit over 95,000 pages. Trump's first year, it came down to 62,000 pages, which is pretty significant. Still a lot, but that's pretty significant. And numbers of regulations, too, dropped a great deal under the Trump administration. Obama had issued over 3,800. Now, those have been up over 5,000 back in the 90s. But they had come down to, they were 3,800 under Obama. Then in Trump's first year, they came down to 3,200. So he is largely, at least in terms of the regulatory state that we look at in terms of the Federal Register, he slowed things down. Now, all of this could be derailed if he pursues antitrust action, if he pursues trade restrictions, if he supports the kind of pork like we see with export-import banks, things of that sort. So, but at least in terms of the regulatory roundups that you typically think of in terms of what agencies are producing, those have slowed significantly under the Trump administration.
Certainly there are things that Congress could do that would really impact the economy in a negative way, would really, as you said, Wayne, would get rid of a lot of the benefits from deregulation. Let's stick with some of the big numbers here, though, for a second, because these just sort of jump out at me and they fascinate me. 61,000 pages in the Federal Registry. That's down from where Obama was, but it's still a lot. 3,200 regulations. Okay, sure. Again, less than Obama and George W. Bush, but still a lot. Certainly Trump has done a lot of things with regard to executive order, but as you guys point out in this report, Congress really has to get involved here, and they have to stay involved if this deregulatory agenda or this deregulatory momentum, however you want to put it, if that's going to continue.
See, Obama always said he had a pen and phone, and if Congress didn't act, he was going to use the pen and phone to enact his agenda. And a lot of his agenda did depend on a Hillary Clinton victory. Similarly, that pen and phone can be used not just to curtail liberty, but within the rule of law, a president can use it to expand liberty, too. Could delay rules that are in the proposed stage. They're streamlining that can be done. You can slow the aggressiveness of agencies, and Trump has done that. But it's vulnerable, too, to the agencies themselves who want to turn things around. If you kind of look over the horizon, although Trump has met his two-for-one requirements in a technical way, I mean, these are not major, gigantic regulations or rollbacks of, you know, huge sectors of regulation, but technically he's met it. But when you look at what agencies are planning in the longer term, they're planning to regulate more than deregulate. So I think that's significant. So it does require Congress to act. Now, Congress has done its job. It passed several resolutions of disapproval, wiping out some of Obama's midnight rules, passed the RAINS Act, which is legislation that will require Congress to approve major agency rules before they're effective. So Congress has done its job. It's the Senate where all of this bogs down. And when I have debates with my friends on the left, I always like to point out that back in the 90s, the last time we had a substantial congressional regulatory reform, it was small business regulatory relief and also the Congressional Review Act itself, the very one that was so controversial where agencies where Congress was turning back some of Obama's rules. The Congressional Review Act passed the Senate 100-0 back in 1996. We are nothing like that now. You couldn't even begin to imagine that kind of uniformity, that kind of unanimous consent to do something about the regulatory enterprise in this, you know, this is a very, very contentious political environment.
We are talking with Wayne Cruz. He's the Vice President of Policy at CEI, and talking about their new report titled 10,000 Commandments. Wayne, one of the big things that really jumps out to me in this report every single year is your estimate of this hidden tax. $1.9 trillion every year that's taken out of Americans' wallets because of regulation. That is an incredible amount of money. It's actually larger than all of the money that the IRS collects from individual and corporate income taxes every year. It's so much money.
That's a huge amount of money. If it were a country, it would be the eighth largest country. And if you go back a little ways in history, it wasn't that long ago that the entire federal budget was $2 trillion. No one would dream of not tabulating or exposing or disclosing how much the federal budget, how much the federal government spends. But when it comes to the off-budget regulatory tax, we're just in a different universe.
And all of this goes on off the budget, and in the background, Congress never really votes on any of this. We all pay for it, though, and all of that is detailed, at least the best estimates that we can get in this new report from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. 10,000 commandments are really terrific, or maybe really terrifying, depending on how you look at it. Look at the federal regulatory state. Wayne, we are unfortunately out of time, but thanks for taking some time with us today.
You bet. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
And you can check out the 10,000 Commandments report and everything else that Wayne and his colleagues are working on, and they do some fantastic work in the policy space. You can find all of that at CEI.org. That's CEI.org. And after you're done there, head on over to Reason.com. Check out what we're working on as well. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bain. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
This past week, the nation of Israel marked the 70th anniversary of its founding. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA talks about the struggles Israel continues to face.
The week just ended includes a very significant birthday that has not received the media coverage that it deserves, the 70th anniversary of the birth of the modern state of Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu's remarks were unsurprisingly positive and forward-looking. Here are some of his words on the occasion. This year, Israel celebrates its 70th anniversary. That's 70 years of freedom, 70 years of democracy, 70 years of bettering the world. Israel's success didn't happen overnight. Men and women from every walk of life, young and old, Jew, Christian, Muslim, religious and secular, men and women that have worked hard to build our nation. As I travel around the world meeting other leaders, I am struck by their appreciation and admiration for Israel. They seek Israel's technology. They seek Israel's ingenuity. They seek Israel's genius. I am proud that Israel is helping people in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, and in many other places to live healthier and safer lives. Here's the best part. We're just getting started. 70 years is the blink of an eye in historical terms. I have no doubt that 70 years from now, Israel will be even stronger, even more prosperous than it is today. Thank you to our many friends around the world. Happy birthday, Israel. In the year 70, the menorah went out, but today, in Israel's 70th anniversary, the menorah is our country's symbol, and its light is stronger than ever. Addressing the enemies of Israel, Netanyahu proudly stated that in another 70 years, you'll find here a country that is many times stronger because of what we've done until today is just the beginning. Today, there are those who want to extinguish the light in Zion. I promise you this will not happen, because our light will always overcome their darkness. We are as strong and determined as ever, he declared to the crowd's applause. We don't hesitate to confront those who want to eradicate us, because we know that defending ourselves with our own force is the essence of independence. Netanyahu added, our hand is outstretched for peace with any of our neighbors who seek peace. Admiration towards Israel is finally trickling to Arab countries. Here, I believe, lie real seeds for peace, he said. He said Israel would always rise to the challenge of defending itself against its enemies if necessary. Its capacity to defend itself by itself, he said, is the essence of independence. How would you characterize those remarks? One newspaper called them fiery and combative. Particularly in today's world of increasingly overheated rhetoric, I don't think they're even close to being fiery and combative. I think they are the words of a strong leader when strong leaders are needed. They're realistic about the existential threat condition that Israel faces every day and the need for that tiny nation to defend itself, but offered without the belligerence and prejudice towards its neighboring countries that is typical of their statements towards Israel. Netanyahu's remarks are positively inclusive, not divisive or combative. I was privileged to travel to Israel a few years ago as the guest of an organization that was committed to supporting a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that has persisted for all of Israel's 70 years of independence. I came away with the opposite conclusion. When I was able to appreciate the actual lay of the land, it became clear to me that a two-state solution is unsustainable and intrinsically divisive. Putting two well-armed adversaries in such close proximity, literally staring over the fence at each other, is no solution at all. Israeli Jews and Palestinian Muslims must live together, woven into a single national tapestry. Israel's economic prosperity should be as accessible to its Arab citizens as it is to its Jewish citizens. The Palestinian hatred for Israel is at least partly, if not mostly, sustained because of the grinding poverty in Gaza and the West Bank. Israel's economy is robust, growing, and in need of more workers. As we join with our ally Israel in celebrating its 70 years of independence, let's also admit that forcing an unnatural two-state solution onto it is unlikely to allow Israel to last for another 70 years. Prime Minister Netanyahu is right, although he doesn't go as far as I just have. Happy 70th birthday, Israel. America is with you.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WMCE-FM in Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our new listeners in the Keystone State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.